heard on the radio the other night, if you smile, you look more confident. That's how people perceive you. Well, what a confident bunch of meditators we have in this evening. We're all smiling. I call tonight's talk Mindfulness, the Quiet Revolution. The inspiration, or the idea behind the talk, was that we're trying to promote the new book, and I was thinking of, well, how do you create some kind of narrative around that in order to interest various publications in being interested in reviewing the book and so forth. And it occurred to me that mindfulness is an extraordinarily popular pursuit or practice these days. A lot of people are teaching it, a lot of people are practicing it. And the idea was, well, given that it did indeed come from Buddhism, there's no harm in surfing that wave in terms of promoting the book. So I thought, well, I better do a little bit of research on this, because undoubtedly it's a good thing that people practice mindfulness. It's excellent. It's wonderful that so many people are turning towards it in whatever way in order to lessen their own personal suffering and lessen the amount of suffering in the world. However, you do hear reports about varying levels of competency in the teaching, in the instruction, and various issues that arise for people who do practice it. So I thought a little bit of research wouldn't go amiss. There are mindfulness courses for all kinds of people in all kinds of situations. Professionals, they're teaching it in Parliament. Politicians are learning mindfulness. Parents, looking after little kids. People are turning to it in order to help with weight loss, insomnia. I saw there was a podcast on one of the online editions of one of the newspapers. There was a podcast on how to deal mindfully with insomnia. And of course, things like anxiety and depression. And undoubtedly, it's really, really good. And mindfulness is the one way to overcome such things as depression, anxiety, and so forth. So it's a very good thing. I do have some issues with it, the way it's presented. But overall, in the little bit of research that I did, I certainly came across one description of what one particular teacher of mindfulness does, and I thought it was very, very good. What do we mean by mindfulness? That's the most critical thing, of course. We must remember that mindfulness is, you don't have to create mindfulness. We all have mindfulness as a mental quality. We couldn't function as human beings without this quality of mindfulness. So it's not something that you create. It's something that you stimulate, something that you build the muscle of your mindfulness. Something that you develop. One interesting definition I found on one of the sites I looked at was paying attention on purpose, moment by moment, without judging. Pretty good, I thought. Paying attention on purpose, moment by moment, without judging. Another definition, one that I know that Alan and Jackie James used, I know Krishnamurti used it too, choiceless awareness. Awareness without picking and choosing what you're aware of. And I've often used the term inner honesty. I quite like that one, because mindfulness is about being honest about what is actually there. So it's about truth, it's about actuality, it's about reality. What is the reality of this moment? Without flinching, without turning away, without saying, oh, it should be different. So, this particular person, I thought it was a very good account of what in Buddhism we call the four foundations of mindfulness. So I might sort of give you an account of what it was that, this is Buddha-less mindfulness, and yet it seems to it seemed to sum up these four foundations of mindfulness so perfectly. You start with body mindfulness. Body mindfulness is the first foundation of mindfulness. And so the idea is that you scan your body, or you attend to the breath, but what you're doing is grounding the mind in the moment, because the body is happening now. It's not happening yesterday or tomorrow, it's happening right now. So by paying proper attention, paying attention on purpose, moment by moment, without judging the sensations that occur in the body, that brings you into the moment. Okay? So they always start the practice in that way. And that's very, very sensible. If you're meditating and you're feeling a little bit confused, or the mind is very scattered, it makes sense to take time to scan the body. What sensations can I feel? Where are the tension areas? Can I dissolve those tension areas with my attention? So it's coming into the body. If you start with the mind, it's too flighty. It just goes everywhere a million miles an hour. The body is grosser. So if you pay attention to body first, then you can begin to discover what's going on in the mind. Typically, what you first become aware of is whether you're feeling good or not. Are you feeling good or are you feeling bad? And the instance that I was looking at, it was somebody who was experiencing depression. So having become aware of the body, they then become aware that they're feeling bad. Feeling is the second foundation of mindfulness in Buddhism. So it is inevitable that when you become aware of your body and you're grounded in your body, you start to become aware of what's going on in the mind. It's a general sense of feeling good or not feeling good. So in this case, it's somebody who regularly experiences depression, so that they became aware that there was a bad feeling. So they're advised, the instruction is, to look at what kind of thoughts they're having at that time. And lo and behold, they discover that the thoughts they're having are very self-critical. They're self-critical thoughts. Now, knowing the state of your mind in this way, knowing that self-critical thoughts are present, in Buddhism we call that the third foundation of mindfulness. Mindfulness of states of mind. All make sense so far? For those that are familiar with four foundations of mindfulness, I don't know it will make particular sense. This is why I thought, yeah, this is good stuff. Okay, so then they are advised, and this is the beautiful part, of course, in recognizing the negative thought process, to abandon it, to make it desist. You're laughing, you know what's coming, don't you? And instead, place a positive thought in its place. So if it is that, I don't know, the self-criticism might be, oh, you said something bad to somebody at work and now you're beating yourself up about it. The idea is you replace that with, say, positive thought about your good qualities, or perhaps a recollection of gratitude, perhaps, or a recollection of good fortune, something which gives you, in that moment, a more positive form of thought. Now, in Buddhism, we call this right effort. And the fourth foundation of mindfulness is called mindfulness of tamas. A tamma really means the Buddha's teaching. And it's like the four foundation of mindfulness is like the collection, the basket of all the Buddha's teaching, which you then apply to your experience in the moment and are able to give a context and a narrative and a framework and practical measures in order to balance the mind. And I found all this, of course, I had to interpret it, but I brought out the fact that actually what they were teaching are the four foundations of mindfulness as taught by the Buddha. So I thought, wow, that's cool, that's good, I like that. And if somebody is teaching in that way, I think that's brilliant. Because if somebody practices in that way, they really will be able to do something about their depression. What struck me in reading it was the fact that somebody who undertakes that kind of practice, who practices those four right efforts, has gone through a process where they've stopped blaming the world for their suffering and that they've taken responsibility, which is a cornerstone of the Buddha's teaching. The Buddha maintains that there is suffering. There is depression, there is anxiety, there is being confronted with what we don't like, being denied what we like. These are the realities of life. And he also said, passionately resisting is the cause of subsequent suffering. So if you keep on resisting, it's just going to get worse and worse and worse. He maintained that there was actually freedom from suffering and laid down a comprehensive teaching in order to allow somebody to reach that cessation of suffering. So anybody who undertakes mindfulness has gone through that major point in life where they stop blaming the world and they take responsibility for their own minds and they start to determine where it is that they're resisting, where they're not accepting life as it is, and they, what are they doing? They're learning to abandon, they're learning to let go. Learning to stop resisting. So, again, I was very taken with that. I thought that was great. Where I do have a few issues, and I think it's worth pointing a few of these out. One of the drawbacks that people were talking about were that people were, for instance, they were experiencing memory flashbacks to past traumas, past anxieties, past events, and that they didn't know how to deal with them. Some people reported the fact that when they started this process, it all started to get worse, not better. A few people actually practiced in exactly the right way and had an experience of emptiness. And then had a major reaction to that. And these are all things that do occur when you practice mindfulness. It's a classic. I'm always so pleased when a student comes and talks to me and says, it's getting worse, because I know it's getting better. You have to see the extent of the problem. Then you can start doing something about it. And as we become more aware, more mindful, we start to actually see there's an awful lot of CRAP going on that we weren't even aware of. And it's that recognition that starts to allow proper practice. Memory flashbacks are not a problem if you understand condition-dependent origination, if you understand action and result, if you understand that the results of our actions are experienced as feelings and perceptions, and that it is our response to them that determines whether we now suffer. We all have memories. Some are painful. And sometimes it requires a steady hand at the tiller. It requires the presence of somebody who has already traversed these difficult waters in order to help us through. Same again with emptiness. Fantastic. Fantastic. The reaction, though, is the reaction of the ego. Because the untrained mind is caught in this deep, deep, deep rooted belief in the existence of a separate self, in the duality. The experience of emptiness, in whatever shape or form it arises, is the clear recognition of the absence of any separation. And the ego goes, we're not having this. And it pulls its biggest trick out of the hat. Here, do some anxiety, do some real fear. Oh, here I am again, the ego's back. Thank goodness for that. You need support. We have a sangha, what we call in Buddhism a sangha, a community, a teacher, because that's so necessary. Because we're not mucking around here, it's a serious business. And these things will come up, but they needn't be huge issues if you've got the right training. So that fourth foundation of mindfulness, mindfulness of tamas, is so important because it gives us what we call clear comprehension. And one of the things I think is that's sometimes missing in mindfulness as it's taught in the wider community is that it lacks this clear comprehension to go with the mindfulness. But you do need that clear comprehension. And the problem is that someone can form a wrong view about mindfulness practice. They can get into a difficult situation like that, not have the support, and determine that practicing mindfulness is somehow wrong. And that becomes an established wrong view. And that takes someone down the wrong path. So, from that point of view, but I'd have to point out, it's going to be the rare exception. I think the vast majority of people are going to be helped enormously through practicing mindfulness. I've got another bugbear on the subject. It's, how to put this across, it's where somebody, and I did see an occasion of this where somebody was saying, oh, well, I want to do secular mindfulness because I want to avoid all that woolly, vague, New Age gobbledygook. And I was like, are you talking about Buddha Dhamma? Are you talking about Buddha's teaching? And they were. Now, I found that quite difficult, actually, because, for first off, this whole idea of secular mindfulness is ridiculous because the Buddha didn't teach a religion. So you can't have a secular version because it's not religious. It's a life training. Training is in how life works. So from that point of view, I thought, well, that's misinformation. That's a very grievous misinterpretation. It's setting a narrative that's actually completely untrue. There is nothing woolly or vague or gobbledygook about the Buddha's teaching. It is the most exact, precise, well thought out, brilliantly devised piece of enlightened genius as you will ever discover. It's in that fourth foundation of mindfulness. You've got this wonderful description of exactly how your mind works, going right deep down into the conditioned and conditioning phenomena as they arise moment by moment, which is able to tease out and explain all the relationships, the interrelationships that go on in the most minute detail. Woolly? Vague? Gobbledygook? Ha. So, in addition, I would have to point out that, give you two quotes from the Buddha. The Buddha did indeed say that mindfulness was the one way to the cessation of suffering. It is. Anyone who practices mindfulness in the right way to any degree will begin to resolve issues of anxiety, depression, and the like. But he also said this: I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the cessation of suffering. His teaching is designed for that one purpose, for the total elimination of anxiety, fear, depression. The Noble Eightfold Path that he taught, neither deficient or excessive in what it gives. You can't just take out mindfulness and leave the other seven parts of the path. And as I've tried to describe to you, nobody actually does. The conclusion I came to was that mindfulness as it's presented in the wider world is good. It does help. People are genuinely helped through practicing that way if they persist, if they continue with it. But I have to give it a term. I would call it mindfulness light. L-I-T-E. Given that everyone's now trying to make spiritual practices into a consumer buying and selling thing, I'm going to add a trademark to that. So it's mindfulness light TM. I haven't actually put in for the trademark yet, but we'll see. I probably won't bother. What I mean by that is that it will take that individual to a certain point. If they do it well, they can overcome their depression. They can overcome their anxiety when it arises. They can have the knowledge and understanding of how to deal with the conscious manifestation of what we call hindrances, to the point where they become so accomplished that, generally speaking, they can manage their minds in such a way that they will enjoy far more sort of peace of mind and balance, and they will be able to go off and perform whatever function they want in life. But that's it. That's as far as it goes. And Buddha Dhamma goes so much further. It goes so much more deeply into existence and explaining and showing the way of how to not just get rid of the conscious manifestations of things like anxiety and depression, but get rid of the roots. So even the potential for those to arise is completely eliminated. The Buddha said, I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the cessation of suffering. He wasn't joking. He meant it. Complete freedom from suffering. So there's another level. And it seems to me, in promoting the book, the best way to promote it is by presenting people with here's another level to it, if you're interested. That's the Buddhist way, of course. You can find out so much more about life than just how to be a bit calmer. It goes so much more deep than that. What I'm calling Max Mindfulness, TM. I'm not really. I'm just joking. Max Mindfulness, TM, is where you go from mindfulness light. You take that basic balance of the mind that you've achieved, and then you investigate life so much more deeply. You go back to these four foundations of mindfulness. You come back to the body, but instead of just using that to ground you, you dive right into materiality. You deeply, intuitively, with the mind, investigate the true nature of materiality in all its forms. You do the same with feeling, with states of mind. And you use this fourth foundation of mindfulness as your guide, as your context. Because in that fourth foundation of mindfulness, you also find what we call ultimate reality, the constituents of ultimate reality, and the three marks of all conditioned phenomena. All, whatever you look at in this deep way, is transient, unsatisfactory, ungraspable. It's all non-self, it's all impersonal. This is the most profound journey you can undertake just sitting in a chair. Well, actually, it's the most profound journey you can take anyway. But the point is, it goes so much further. And you begin to see the world in such a way that challenge the most basic views and assumptions that you had, the way you thought life was. It challenges your perception. It challenges the perception that the objective world that you simply just assume is there as solid, separate objects. The more deeply you go into Vipassana meditation, insight meditation, you see that that's not true at all. Conventionally, yeah, you retain that sense of separateness and separate objects, but the more you look deeply into your moment-by-moment experience, the more you see this web of conditionality, of interplay between these infinite numbers of conditions operating at any one moment, and you can find no abiding self in any of it, you can't find anything at all, because there's nothing that exists independent of that net of conditionality. And that net itself has no solid basis. The elements that you can find are just arising and passing away again and again and again. And it just creates a fundamental revolution in the mind, a quiet revolution, but a revolution nonetheless. Because the world that made you anxious, the world that made you depressed, the world that seemed to just give you what you really always wanted, only to take it away again. You can't find it. You just can't find it. And I know we're all sitting here and you say, you're up there, how can you say you can't see this? Of course I can see you. But when you look with insight, deeply into life, you have finally perfect context. Yes, it appears as though there's this, all these separate elements, but actually it's all part of the same thing. And it's only in our thoughts that conceptual reality of separate beings and objects exists. Only in thought. And that is just the most incredible revolution in mind. I mean, it's a very gradual thing. It's not like you'd be back. Honestly, you can't do it suddenly like that, because you'd be back with the person who saw emptiness for a moment and freaked out. You have to gradually erase the wrong perceptions, the wrong views, the wrong ideas, and gradually you start to see the true reality of things. But through this process, all the craving, all the resistance, all the ignorance that underscores all these neurotic preoccupations we have, worries, the anxieties, the depressions and so forth, they just get completely swept away. And you're left having gone through this quiet revolution. And I do mean it's quiet. I mean, I know someone who lived with two other people for a few months and they didn't know that he was enlightened. Because it's so undemanding. Because when you take away all the resistance, you're just flowing with life. You're just flowing with life. You don't stand out in the same way, because you just flow with it. There's no greed, no aversion, no confusion. The enlightened mind is no longer a cause for the world's problems. They walk lightly through the world. Yeah, they go completely unnoticed. They're still human. They still make mistakes from time to time. They step here and there. But they don't fall into error because of it. They might say the wrong thing at the wrong time, but they don't get depressed, because it was just a completely empty experience. The true meaning of emptiness. That'll do for tonight. I've probably gone on. Oh, good. Alright. Now, what I'm just about to say is woolly, it is vague, it is New Age gobbledygook. Alright? I was out for a run. Went up, running up to Turley, which almost killed me, and maybe this had something to do with maybe warp my perception. But I was in Turley, and one of the big houses there was the most beautiful dog. I think it was a German Shepherd. Are they big, German Shepherds? Beautiful things? Yeah. This one was beautifully kept. It was really well looked after. And he was on the wall, and he was just, you know, obviously looking after his territory. But he looked happy. Tail was wagging. But the thing is, I didn't see a dog. I saw the universe temporarily taking on the appearance of a dog. And if you understand that, it's quite a profound difference, but please don't ask me to explain it. The only way you really can comprehend that yourself is to practice Vipassana meditation. To sum up, got no problem with people practicing mindfulness. It's a really good thing. You've got to be careful. And I think that's why having a real-life human teacher is really, really helpful. I know people use apps on their smartphones. I know that's the modern way to do it. But to me, that's like a grown-up still using stabilizers on their bike. You've got to learn how to self-generate mindfulness. It's so important. But you do have to be careful, and if you practice under the proper guidance, it's fine. Because each time you hit a difficulty, you talk to, you collaborate with the teacher, and the teacher is able to help you the way through that. But it is simply the most sublime, profound undertaking you can do. Perhaps for the vast majority of people, they won't, who do practice mindfulness, will never really appreciate that. And that's a sadness, but that's fine, because they're still getting a lot out of it. But let's hope that the door is open and that people realise that there is this other level that you can take mindfulness to.